No. Lying in the ditch with Billy and the scouts after having been shot at, Weary made Billy take a very close look at his trench knife. It wasn't government issue. It was a present from his father. It had a 10-inch blade that was triangular in cross-section. Its grip consisted of brass knuckles, was a chain of rings through which Weary slipped his stubby fingers. The rings weren't simple. They bristled with spikes. Weary laid the spikes along Billy's cheek, roweled the cheek with savagely affectionate restraint. How'd you like to be hit with this, hmm? Hmm? He wanted to know. I wouldn't, said Billy. Know why the blade's triangular? No. Makes a wound that won't close up. Oh. Makes a three-sided hole in a guy. You stick an ordinary knife in a guy, makes a slit, right? A slit closes right up, right? Right. Shit, what do you know? What the hell they teach in college? I wasn't there very long, said Billy, which was true. He had had only 6 months of college, and the college hadn't been a regular college either. It had been the night school of the Ilium School of Optometry. Joe College, said Weary scathingly. Billy shrugged. There's more to life than what you read in books, said Weary. You'll find that out. Billy made no reply to this either, there in the ditch, since he didn't want the conversation to go on any longer than necessary. He was dimly tempted to say, though, that he knew a thing or two about gore. Billy, after all, had contemplated torture and hideous wounds at the beginning and the end of nearly every day of his childhood. Billy had an extremely gruesome crucifix hanging on the wall of his little bedroom in Ilium. A military surgeon would have admired the clinical fidelity of the artist's rendition of all Christ's wounds, the spear wound, the thorn wounds, the holes that were made by the iron spikes. Billy's Christ died horribly. He was pitiful. So it goes. Billy wasn't a Catholic, even though he grew up with a ghastly crucifix on the wall. His father had no religion. His mother was a substitute organist for several churches around town. She took Billy with her whenever she played, taught him to play a little too. She said she was going to join a church as soon as she decided which one was right. She never did decide. She did develop a terrific hankering for a crucifix, though, and she bought one from a Santa Fe gift shop during a trip the little family made out west during the Great Depression. Like so many Americans, she was trying to construct a life that made sense from the things she found in gift shops. And the crucifix went up on the wall of Billy Pilgrim. The two scouts, loving the walnut stocks of their rifles in the ditch, whispered that it was time to move out again. 10 minutes had gone by without anybody's coming to see if they were hit or not, to finish them off. Whoever had shot was evidently far away and all alone. And the four crawled out of the ditch without drawing any more fire. They crawled into a forest like the big, unlucky mammals they were. Then they stood up and began to walk quickly. The forest was dark and old. The pines were planted in ranks and files. There was no undergrowth. 4 inches of unmarked snow blanketed the ground. The Americans had no choice but to leave trails in the snow as unambiguous as diagrams in a book on ballroom dancing. Step, slide, rest. Step, slide, rest. Close it up and keep it closed, Roland Weary warned Billy Pilgrim as they moved out. Weary looked like Tweedledum or Tweedledee, all bundled up for battle. He was short and thick. He had every piece of equipment he had ever been issued, every present he'd received from home, helmet, helmet liner, wool cap, scarf, gloves, cotton undershirt, woolen undershirt, wool shirt, sweater, blouse, jacket, overcoat, cotton underpants, woolen underpants, woolen trousers, cotton socks, woolen socks, combat boots, gas mask, canteen, mess kit, first aid kit, trench knife, blanket, shelter half, raincoat, bulletproof Bible, a pamphlet entitled Know Your Enemy, another pamphlet entitled Why We Fight, and another pamphlet of German phrases rendered in English phonetics, which would enable Weary to ask Germans questions such as, "Where is your headquarters?" And how many howitzers have you? Or tell them, surrender, your situation is hopeless. And so on. Weary had a block of balsa wood which was supposed to be a foxhole pillow. He had a prophylactic kit containing two tough condoms, for the prevention of disease only. He had a whistle he wasn't going to show anybody until he got promoted to corporal. He had a dirty picture of a woman attempting sexual intercourse with a Shetland pony. He had made Billy Pilgrim admire that picture several times. The woman and the pony were posed before velvet draperies, which were fringed with deedly balls. They were flanked by Doric columns. In front of one column was a potted palm. The picture that Weary had was a print of the first dirty photograph in history. The word photography was first used in 1839, and it was in that year, too, that Louis J. M. Daguerre revealed to the French Academy that an image formed on a silvered metal plate covered with a thin film of silver iodide could be developed in the presence of mercury vapor. In 1841, only 2 years later, an assistant to Daguerre, André Lefebvre, was arrested in the Tuileries Gardens for attempting to sell a gentleman a picture of the woman and the pony. That was where Weary bought his picture, too, in the Tuileries. Lefebvre argued that the picture was fine art and that his intention was to make Greek mythology come alive. He said the columns and the potted palm prove that. When asked which myth he meant to represent, Lefebvre replied that there were thousands of myths like that, with the woman a mortal and the pony a god. He was sentenced to 6 months in prison. He died there of pneumonia. So it goes. Billy and the scouts were skinny people. Roland Weary had fat to burn. He was a roaring furnace under all his layers of wool and straps and canvas. He had so much energy that he bustled back and forth between Billy and the scouts, delivering dumb messages which nobody had sent and which nobody was pleased to receive. He also began to suspect, since he was so much busier than anybody else, that he was the leader. He was so hot and bundled up, in fact, that he had no sense of danger. His vision of the outside world was limited to what he could see through a narrow slit between the rim of his helmet and his scarf from home, which concealed his baby face from the bridge of his nose on down. He was so snug in there that he was able to pretend that he was safe at home, having survived the war, and that he was telling his parents and his sister a true war story, whereas the true war story was still going on. Weary's vision of the true war story went like this. There was a big German attack, and Weary and his anti-tank buddies fought like hell until everybody was killed but Weary. So it goes. And then Weary tied in with two scouts, and they became close friends immediately, and they decided to fight their way back to their own lines. They were going to travel fast. They were damned if they'd surrender. They shook hands all around. They called themselves the Three Musketeers. But then this damn college kid, who was so weak he shouldn't have even been in the army, asked if he could come along. He didn't even have a gun or a knife. He didn't even have a helmet or a cap. He couldn't even walk right. Kept bobbing up and down, driving everybody crazy, giving their position away. He was pitiful. The Three Musketeers pushed and carried and dragged the college kid all the way back to their own lines. Weary's story went. They saved his goddamn hide for him. In real life, Weary was retracing his steps, trying to find out what had happened to Billy. He had told the scouts to wait while he went back for the college bastard. He passed under a low branch now. It hit the top of his helmet with a clunk. Weary didn't hear it. Somewhere a big dog was barking. Weary didn't hear that either. His war story was at a very exciting point. An officer was congratulating the Three Musketeers, telling them that he was going to put them in for Bronze Stars. "Anything else I can do for you boys?" said the officer. "Yes, sir," said one of the scouts. "We'd like to stick together for the rest of the war, sir. Is there some way you can fix it so nobody will ever break up the Three Musketeers?" Billy Pilgrim had stopped in the forest. He was leaning against a tree with his eyes closed. His head was tilted back, and his nostrils were flaring. He was like a poet in the Parthenon. This was when Billy first came unstuck in time. His attention began to swing grandly through the full arc of his life, passing into death, which was violet light. There wasn't anybody else there or anything. There was just violet light and a hum. And then Billy swung into life again, going backwards, until he was in pre-birth, which was red light and bubbling sounds. And then he swung into life again and stopped. He was a little boy taking a shower with his hairy father at the Ilium YMCA. He smelled chlorine from the swimming pool next door, heard the springboard boom. Little Billy was terrified because his father had said Billy was going to learn to swim by the method of sink or swim. His father was going to throw Billy into the deep end, and Billy was going to damn well swim. It was like an execution. Billy was numb as his father carried him from the shower room to the pool. His eyes were closed. When he opened his eyes, he was on the bottom of the pool, and there was beautiful music everywhere. He lost consciousness, but the music went on. He dimly sensed that somebody was rescuing him. Billy resented that. From there, he traveled in time to 1965. He was 41 years old, and he was visiting his decrepit mother at Pine Knoll, an old people's home he had put her in only a month before. She had caught pneumonia and wasn't expected to live. She did live, though, for years after that. Her voice was nearly gone, so in order to hear her, Billy had to put his ear right next to her papery lips. She evidently had something very important to say. "How?" she began, and she stopped. She was too tired. She hoped that she wouldn't have to say the rest of the sentence, that Billy would finish it for her. But Billy had no idea what was on her mind. "How what, Mother?" he prompted. She swallowed hard, shed some tears. Then she gathered energy from all over her ruined body, even from her toes and fingertips. At last, she had accumulated enough to whisper this complete sentence. "How did I get so old?" Billy's antique mother passed out, and Billy was led from the room by a pretty nurse. The body of an old man covered by a sheet was wheeled by just as Billy entered the corridor. The man had been a famous marathon runner in his day. So it goes. This was before Billy had his head broken in an airplane crash, by the way. Before he became so vocal about flying saucers and traveling in time. Billy sat down in a waiting room. He wasn't a widower yet. He sensed something hard under the cushion of his overstuffed chair. He dug it out, discovered that it was a book, The Execution of Private Slovak, by William Bradford Huey. It was a true account of the death before an American firing squad of Private Eddie D. Slovak, 36896415, the only American soldier to be shot for cowardice since the Civil War. So it goes. Billy read the opinion of a staff judge advocate who reviewed Slovak's case, which ended like this. "He has directly challenged the authority of the government, and future discipline depends upon a resolute reply to this challenge. If the death penalty is ever to be imposed for desertion, it should be imposed in this case, not as a punitive measure, nor as retribution, but to maintain that discipline upon which alone an army can succeed against the enemy. There was no recommendation for clemency in the case, and none is here recommended." So it goes.